When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Chinny.
And I'm Astrid, and welcome to It's a Continent, the podcast that widens access to African history. We're also the co-authors of a book by the same name. You can find out more information about us on itsacontinent.com.
We're here to challenge the common misconception that Africa is a country by appreciating the identity of each nation. Through each episode, we'll be exploring key historical moments which have shaped the continent. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of It's a Continent.
Hello, Chinny.
Yes, hello. I mean, it's not just you. I am talking to other people too.
It's just the episode at me.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Shall we go straight into our African Pride?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Who are you giving it to?
So this week's African Pride goes to Kelvin Kipton, who was a Kenyan long-distance runner and the marathon world record holder when he tragically passed away in a car accident at the age of 24. He leaves behind a wife and two children. He ran three of the seven fastest marathons in history and was the top men's marathon runner. He constantly kept beating his own records, becoming only the third man in history to break 2 hours and 2 minutes at the 2022 Valencia Marathon, finishing in first position. And then, at the 2023 London Marathon, set the second fastest marathon in history with a time of 2 hours, 1 minute and 25 seconds, winning the race. 6 months later, at the Chicago Marathon in October 2023, he broke the world record by 34 seconds with a time of 2 hours and 35 seconds. He was truly phenomenal, with these achievements coming in so short a time frame. Tragically, there was so much more for him to have given the world of athletics, with Kipton hoping to have broken the two-hour time at a marathon in Rotterdam in April and was expected to make his Olympic debut in Paris this year. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's
those
really
incredible achievements.
Yes, I mean, to potentially be seeing someone going sub 2 hours in a marathon would have just been unreal. And yeah, it's really tragic, his passing, particularly as he was at the beginning of his career. Yeah.
24, he'd achieved
So much.
Yeah. Wow. So I have props to marathon runners out there, because me and this ultra marathon is not happening
I've seen you doing the running on the Apple Watch.
Yeah,
you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
2 hours?
Sub 2 hours, which was within touching distance for him. So yeah, it's a really sad time.
Where are we?
So this week we're doing a little bit of a theme. It's a little bit of a Black History Month edition right at the end in March. But nonetheless, we are covering Marcus Garvey. He was a Black nationalist and pioneer in Pan-Africanism, with elements of this ideology known today as Garveyism. He encouraged a sense of pride and self-worth amongst African and the African diaspora alike, particularly during a difficult time of poverty, discrimination, and colonization. He also advocated for unity between Africans and the displaced African diaspora through enslavement, including the US and Caribbean islands. And despite having never visited the continent himself, Garvey was committed to the Back to Africa movement. Some have speculated that the reason he didn't visit Africa is because Western colonial authorities would not have provided permission to someone who calls for decolonization, as this would have disrupted the status quo, whilst others had more choice opinions, which we'll get to in this episode.
Garvey was born on August 17, 1887, in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica. He spent some time in Britain, sailing to England in 1912, with the aim of furthering his education. At the time, London only had a few thousand Black people, and they were viewed as exotic, often doing labourer jobs. Marcus Garvey worked at the city's docks, and his sister came to join him in the summer. He ended up taking evening classes in law at Birkbeck College, also taking the time to read in the British Museum's library. During his time here, he came across a book Up From Slavery, a 1901 autobiography of the American educator Booker T. Washington. This influenced Garvey's ideology as he took the similar view that Black Americans empowering themselves through skill and education was important. During his return voyage to Jamaica in 1914, Garvey met an African-Caribbean missionary who went to Basutoland, now Lesotho, and married a Basutu wife. This spurred Garvey to learn more about colonialism, and he dreamt up a movement to politically unite Black people from across the world. During his two-year stint in England, Garvey also witnessed Ireland's struggle for independence, and this was reflected in his ideas and writings. His early Pan-African beliefs stemmed from the Pan-African teachings of Dr. Love and Alexander Bedwood. Once Garvey returned to Jamaica, he launched the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League.
That's a bit of a long acronym, isn't it?
We'll be going onwards with UNIA to cover that, with the mantra, one aim, one God, one destiny. Garvey's commitment was to establish a brotherhood among the Black race, to promote a spirit of race pride, to reclaim the fallen.
Which is great.
Yeah, and to also assist in civilizing the backward tribes of Africa.
Oh.
Oh.
That's a bit of a yikes.
Oh, okay. Okay, we maybe drank too much of that English tea.
Yeah,
civilization.
That message was really being hammered home, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was everywhere.
Yeah.
The Jamaicans didn't take to the word Negro due to earlier connotations, but Garvey wanted the word to be reclaimed for Black people of African descent.
This is interesting because I guess it's because he'd never been to Africa himself, but it just goes to show the extent of what was going on. And I think sometimes some Black diasporan leaders might have felt, oh, we need to lift ourselves up and feeling that we are the reason why we're in a position that we are, when it's actually sometimes more of the structural piece.
Mm.
So it's a bit of both, you know.
Yeah.
In 1916, Garvey came to America at Booker T. Washington's invitation, but arrived just after Washington died. He travelled around the US observing the struggle African Americans were up against in the quest for basic human rights. As Black soldiers returned from the First World War, they moved with their families into cities like Chicago and Tulsa, where race riots erupted. It then became clear that white Americans were not going to treat African Americans differently, even though they had just fought for the country that continually belittled and abused them, similar patterns to what we saw in African countries following World War II, for example. Under the disillusionment caused by returning from the First World War, Garvey began calling for the formation of a united Africa for the Africans of the world, as he promoted his views that Africa was a natural homeland for the African diaspora. At this point, Garvey believed that the law in the US would never change underlying racial prejudices. So this kind of ties into our episode on Liberia.
Oh, yeah.
Also season one, I think that might have been, where they had this sort of back to Africa movement.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that some people believe that, well, we don't want to be non-racist. Can we just...
Just send them...
Just...
In that general direction.
Because we're not changing our minds. Yeah. Let's just send them away. Garvey went on to establish a UNIA branch in the Harlem district of New York. As president of UNIA, the organization helped those in need by establishing a vocational training college in a way like his hero Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute. UNIA ended up becoming the largest mass movement in African-American history, and by the early 1920s, there were more than 700 branches in 38 US states. The organization had a rich religious component that Garvey blended with political and economic aspects. And in a way, this is like the Black theology we see with Steve Biko decades later in South Africa, with Garvey's belief that it was God's will for Black people to determine their own destiny. UNIA's message was that of Black nationalism and the return to Africa for all people of African descent. This brand of Black activism was that of unity, pride in African cultural heritage, and complete autonomy, believing that people of Black African descent could establish an independent nation in their ancient homeland of Africa. Garvey consistently encouraged African Americans to be proud of their heritage and appearance. He long said Black is beautiful before the 1960s. He encouraged the community to canonize their own saints, create their own martyrs, and elevate to positions of fame and honor Black men and women who had made their distinct contributions to our racial history. He also encouraged parents to give their children dolls that look like them to play with and cuddle.
It's so interesting to see, like, yes, those messages, we're still, you know,
we're still there,
reinforcing them, yeah, and making sure that it's out there and that we do have that sense of pride in the community. And mm-hmm, wow, and he was just doing it, yeah, way back when.
Way back when.
And it was needed as well, yeah.
Definitely.
UNIA was corporate and politically minded. As the organisation grew, Garvey purchased an auditorium in Harlem, naming it Liberty Hall after the Dublin location, as he admired and was fascinated by the Irish independence movement. UNIA held nightly meetings with audiences of up to 6,000 people. The message was loud and proud, with Garvey saying, "I am the equal of any white man. I want you to feel the same way." Can you imagine how radical this was at a time when Jim Crow was in full swing? He was an eloquent orator and regularly empowered his audiences. The organization continued expanding, with the UNIA's first international convention taking place in 1920. People lined the streets of Harlem to watch Garvey and his followers in military clothing. This was the African Legion. People waved banners saying, "We want a black civilization and Africa must be free." This is so interesting because it's going around, you know, the backdrop of, oh, this was, sorry.
This was before, yeah, this, yeah, is this what was, we say. This, yeah, is even, yeah, before.
Like, this was, this way was before, yeah.
A pioneer, definitely. Yeah.
Controversially, the UNIA convention went on to designate Garvey as the provisional president of the African Republic, and believed they were a government in exile. They would take power in the continent when European colonial rule ended. Some West Africans were angered by this, as they thought it was wrong that a Jamaican, rather than African, was taking on the position. Those outside the UNIA movement also ridiculed Garvey for giving himself this role.
Yeah, the title, yeah, I was going to say, the title reminds me of when Gaddafi declared himself King of Kings of Africa.
Yeah,
yeah, it is that Gaddafi, giving, it was, yeah, giving sort of shades of delusion.
He has, the intention is there and he's saying, yeah, what is needed, but maybe, because at this point, I'm assuming he hasn't really involved African nations.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, make sure to...
How do we bring everyone on board?
Yeah, so it, yeah, doesn't seem like it's sort of being just spearheaded by one and really bringing that, having that community feel to it. The UNIA established growing links with the Liberian government. And yes, we do. You mentioned it already. We do have an episode on Liberia. Season one.
Yes, I remember that. It is season one.
Garvey sent some of his team to assess the prospect of mass African-American settlement there. Well, he was really like, right, we are doing on it. Just the involvement of actual nations and people. Just,
the stakeholder management wasn't quite.
Wow, spoken like a...
like a true corporate babe. Here's the complicated relationship with capitalism. Garvey believed economic success was the most assured route to independence for black people, intentionally distancing himself from black socialist groups and opposing attempts to recruit African-Americans into the trade union movement. He believed the communist movement didn't serve the interest of black Americans as it was a white person's creation. In 1919, Garvey established the Negro Factories Corporation, offering stock for African-Americans to buy and be self-sufficient. The corporation operated grocery stores, restaurants, a printing plant and steam laundry, as well as building and shipping lorries. I mean, it makes sense because African Americans at this point were so far behind in terms of generational wealth.
Yeah.
The priority for them, maybe that was why. Maybe that was why he felt that they had to become capitalists to make up for all that lost time. The most famous and perhaps controversial initiative was the shipping venture Black Star Line. This was a challenge to white domination of the maritime industry, particularly against the White Star Line, a British shipping line which went on to hold the ill-fated Titanic, which it never recovered from. The Black Star Line's aim was to promote trade and transport passengers to the African continent. Garvey promised financiers would receive significant returns on investment when the company started returning profit. However, this venture was ultimately unsuccessful due to infiltration by American federal agents.
Oh, so they didn't want...
Well, I mean, a black man owning a shipping company? Oh, heavens.
Marcus Garvey was a bit like Marmite. Not everyone within the black diaspora community were aligned to his cause. By 1922, Garvey's stance evolved from being a confrontation with white America to advocating for racial separatism. Some of these beliefs were controversial, as Garvey applauded white people who promoted the idea of sending African Americans to Liberia.
Yeah, it makes sense because you understand the belief is the same, as in he's saying, let's go back to Africa to empower ourselves. But they're saying, let's send her back to Africa because we want to be racist.
Yeah, so it's not. Yeah. In June 1922, Garvey met a KKK leader in the state of Georgia to discuss their views on mixed race relationships and social equality. This caused widespread surprise, hurt and anger from African Americans, and it was the most significant turning point in his popularity. This is just... Oh, you know when you're just like, you were there, but then you keep taking, like, you keep one step forward and it feels like you're taking steps back at the same time. It is an awkward situation when you find yourself agreeing with the KKK, as they also supported the policy of no race mixing, advocated for racial separation, and advocated Black Americans migrating to Africa. Garvey was willing to collaborate with the KKK to achieve these aims. And in his words, they were better friends, as he believed they were more honest about their intentions.
I guess it's, in a way, I can sort of see where he's coming from, because it's like, in the UK, we have a lot of, what do they always call it? Like the subtle racism, you know, that covert racism. I mean, where they'll be nice to you, but they're actually racist inside.
Mm.
So maybe he just preferred the approach of, okay, this person is racist. I can see the tattoo. I will not be engaging.
But then I feel like he then took it a step where he was like, I am engaged.
I will work with you.
I will work with you too.
I will never talk to you.
Yeah. W.E.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson of the NAACP had their doubts. Rather shadily, Du Bois described Garvey as a little fat Black man, ugly with intelligent eyes and a big head.
Very shady.
Tension between UNIA and the NAACP continued, as the NAACP believed Garvey to be a hindrance to racial integration in the US, particularly as he rejected the melting pot notion.
Yeah. Like, his brand of Black nationalism was, let's have our own place, let's be separate,
we don't need to suck up
to these people. Whereas other people were looking at integration and trying to forge relationships with white Americans.
Yeah, I think they both had similar ideas of kind of wanting to be free, but their approaches were way very too different. Yeah. And I feel like maybe, I wonder whether they felt that Garvey was out of touch, like he wasn't in the experience fully to appreciate the complexities of it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, completely. And they did often, because he was Jamaican and not African-American by heritage, they did often be like, oh, you're not American, you know. So they did sort of play that card a few times. And some in the African community saw Marcus Garvey as pretentious and even to some extent a populist demagogue. This is because he held some links with white supremacists, as laid out, and held some prejudices against those with mixed racial heritage. In his words, he believed mixed heritage people were torn by dual allegiances and would ally themselves with the more powerful race. This especially caused friction between Garvey and Du Bois, and some of his views included the idea that an elite group of African Americans of, in his words, the purest African blood, with education and skill, should be the ones to migrate to Africa, and the rest should remain in the US, where they would become extinct within 50 years. So it's not really given a positive view, because you then start to think that you're better than others. Garvey envisioned the creation of a Black Republic and a one-party state where the president, i.e. him, would have absolute authority to appoint all major positions. Though bear in mind, Garvey had never visited the African continent, didn't speak any of the languages, and clearly knew nothing about the continent's varied customs, languages, religions, and traditional social cultures, like how in Liberia we saw the black-on-black colonization for that very reason.
Yeah.
Because they did think that they were better than the Africans. Because they literally said, well, we need to civilize these people.
Which,
very strange. Claude McKay, a Jamaican writer and poet central to the Harlem Renaissance, held the view that Garvey spoke of, in his words, of Africa as if it were a little island in the Caribbean Sea. To be fair, we're not too far off the black-on-black colonization assessment, as Garvey did believe negative stereotypes about Africa. I mean, they were floating around at the time, as one of his stated aims was to assist in civilizing the backward tribes of Africa, and he wanted to promote a conscientious Christian worship in his quest for civilization. Others believed that it was condescending, that there was a belief that only Africa could be liberated from colonialism by Africans and diaspora. So it kind of reminds you of, was it Black Panther when that came out and someone was like, oh, guys, we need to hold screenings in Africa so that we can show people like what black people could do on screen. You're just like,
oh, wait, someone.
And you're just
there is like a whole film industry.
Music industry,
in the, like
all the adverts on TV, soaps, dramas, like it's sometimes a dice world could be a bit out of touch, you know?
Yeah. But it's I feel like he had the intention was there, but I think the fact that even I understand, he never visited it, but I think did he actually just spend some time really understanding it, even though he was here to really understand the complexities of it and actually appreciate it. It just sort of feels like, okay, I want to do this.
Mm.
I will be the president.
Of course I will decide. Of course I will.
But
yeah,
are you actually talking to people? We don't know. Could we argue that Garvey's tools at the time were limited? Prominent Black Americans launched the Garvey Must Go campaign, which played to nativist ideas because obviously he was from Jamaica, and they called for his deportation. Black media at the time described Garvey as a messenger boy for the Klan and a supreme Negro Jamaican jackass. It did not, the KKK conversation did not help.
It was wild.
The US Federal Bureau took an interest in Garvey and in 1922 indicted him for mail fraud, sentencing him to prison.
I mean, yeah, they were probably just looking for reasons to send him to prison at this point because he is whipping these African Americans into action. They are empowered and we need to stop this.
We need to stop it now. Garvey began his sentence in 1925 and 2 months later, the sentence was commuted and he ended up back in Jamaica after being deported. UNIA lost momentum after Garvey's imprisonment and deportation. When he returned to Jamaica in the late 20s, Garvey was just about the best known black man in the whole world. There's no denying that Marcus Garvey's influence and Garveyism ideology extended well beyond the US border, spreading to Caribbean nations, Canada, and the African continent. Elijah Poole, who later became Elijah Muhammad, was a Garveyite in Chicago and later became leader of the Nation of Islam. UNIA was the largest black mass movement in modern history and were responsible for the first black mass protest crusade in the history of the US. Ultimately, Garveyism gave black people self-assertion and self-reliance. Along with W.E.B. Du Bois, he is seen as the father of Pan-Africanism and was sometimes mockingly called the Negro Moses, as he was seen as someone who would lead his people out of their oppressive situation.
Yeah, so we've said all of that to say this, that we're not taking away from the influence that he's had, but it was just interesting to see him from
all
points of view. And it's interesting that even W.E.B. Du Bois didn't really like him, which is interesting because I had no idea.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot to be said with a lot of these, when we do these profiles on people, it is not as straightforward of being like, yes,
yeah,
we're all for absolutely everything. They do make...
It's not binary.
Not the best. They also make terrible decisions on their way through
human.
It.
Yeah.
And for him, I guess his mistakes was probably not fully grasping the challenges being faced by and Africans in the continent and having that reality and really bringing them along with him.
Living in countries where this is the message that he's just always getting about.
Yeah. I think that probably reinforced his view of the world as well, which you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't exactly
blame him for.
Garvey gave African descended people a feeling of collective pride and a sense of individual worth, laying the groundwork for the civil rights movement to come in the 1950s and 1960s. By the late 1920s, Garvey gained ties with Comité de Défense de la Race Noire, a French black movement. So that, again, just goes to show that other diaspora movements across the world have taken inspiration from him.
Yeah.
Marcus Garvey died in London on the 10th of June 1940 after ill health. Did he get his flowers whilst he was alive? An interest in Garvey was revived in the 1960s through independent states in Africa and the emergence of the Black Power movement in the US. So bear in mind, a lot of Garvey's actions were 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. So it's, and we think of the Black Power movement 60s, 70s, he was their inspiration. So it just goes to show his contribution there. Garveyism provided a boost to African leaders calling for independence from colonial rule. Kwame Nkrumah was heavily influenced by Garvey, and in his autobiography, said Garvey's writings inspired him. The Ghana Black Star Line is a shipping company bearing the same name as Garvey's former company. The Ghanaian football team is also called the Black Stars, and the national flag adopted the Pan-African colours of UNIA. So that's where you get those Pan-African colours from. In 1962, Jamaica hailed Garvey as a hero, and he was posthumously conferred with the Order of the National Hero. His body was returned to Jamaica in 1964, and he is buried in the National Heroes Park in Kingston. The Rastafari movement also revived interest in Garvey after his death, and in 1965, Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King visited Garvey's shrine, laying a wreath. In a speech, MLK noted that Garvey was the first man to give millions of Negroes a sense of dignity and destiny on a mass scale and level. And he was the first man to make the Negro feel that he was somebody. So,
yeah, and I think that's huge. I think that's what his legacy really is that sense of you have every right to be whatever you want to be and do. Mm-hmm. You can own this space. Mm-hmm. Garveyism didn't only influence Black movements, as the Vietnamese communist revolutionary Ho Chi Minh said Garvey and Korean nationalists shaped his political outlook.
Which, yeah, it's a bit ironic because Garvey hated communism, but here he is, influencing people that...
just from anywhere.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's so important to have a look at... Because you hear the name and I've heard, like, you know, Marcus Garvey, but I've never really known
his story. No, it was... a trip across the pond, that one.
We're in America this time. Like Jamaica.
Sort of. But yes, thanks for listening to It's a Continent. You can follow us on Instagram at It's a Continent Pod, on Twitter or X, or X, formerly known as Twitter. It's a Continent Pod.
We'll get better at that.
And our website, itsacontinent.com, and our newsletter, itsacontinent.com/newsletter.
And we'll see you soon.